Welcome to the event. We're just waiting for Alan to get back with some tape so he can put a little lavalier mic on here because we're recording the event in high def for future generations and researchers and people who are interested in the beginnings of computing and personal computing. But I'll just give you a little bit of an introduction, just an introduction before the introduction, unless somebody has some masking tape. No. Nerds, where are you? Sort of the genesis of the DigiBarn project. I'll tell you about the DigiBarn because that'll sort of, it's a good time filler. Some of you may have come to our session yesterday. The DigiBarn Computer Museum was started by me kind of starting collecting in 1987 because we were working with Xerox PARC at the time to take some of the user interface innovations from PARC and put them out on top of DOS machines, if you can believe that. So I wrote an operating system, an operating environment that ran on DOS that had Windows and icons and whatnot before sort of Windows 1.0 had come out and the Mac was out. But I wrote something that looked like Xerox. And I got really interested in where did all this graphical interface stuff come from. And truthfully, it came from people sitting on beanbag chairs at Palo Alto Research Center. That was a big chunk of it, at least for the Valley. And so I started the DigiBarn project to try to tell the history of the birth of personal computing and graphical interfaces. And the project then expanded outward to encompass everything, which you can see on the DigiBarn site, but it also expanded backward in time to get back to this project. And I'm going to let Alan set this mic up so we'll capture this properly. And for me, this is kind of an ultimate event for the DigiBarn because it truthfully is taking us back way to the early mists of time and the birth of the idea of computing devoted to one person, interactive computing devoted to one person. And I think we're just about
one more piece.
It's worth it, folks.
It's a second
Bluetooth mic so that when it's handed around to you guys, we'll catch your voices properly.
And everybody else.
And the audience. And Alan, we've to...
Close it up, tape the on switch.
Tape the on switch. Alan and I co-founded the DigiBarn in 1998. And we're quite a motley crew. We're sometimes called the Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers of vintage computing, because we do these shows together and we go
bit and bite.
Bit and bite.
There you go.
All right, how's our sound level? It's good. So just to get started, so the DigiBarn project was interested in the idea, the concept of interacting with computer worlds. And for me, initial fascinations were systems like the Alto. Very fascinating. We did a 30th anniversary of the Alto 5 years ago. And other systems that derive from the innovations in GUIs. We've still got the noise back there. Can they just shut it completely off? Thank you very much. Thanks, Alex. Sorry about this. So I was leading a tour of the DigiBarn Computer Museum, I think, what was it, about a year and a half ago? And thanks to this young lady here, she brought along Severo Ornstein, who's sitting right here. And he was very polite, because here I am giving my tour sort of through the timeline of the museum, and I go past the Alto, and I talk about it. I go past the Altair, talk about it. And he politely listens, and I keep going. We go up the stairs. We talk about the birth of graphical interface in the 70s, the birth of the concept of personal computing in the 70s. And at the very end of the tour, Severo says, "Excuse me, but have you heard of the Link?" And my foggy brain, which has been mainly focused on computing since 1970, 72, goes back and clicks and, okay, college course, computer science, 1982. Yeah, there was a machine called LNIC, and I said, sort of. Didn't want to seem like a complete idiot, which of course I was at that moment, about the link. And then he proceeded to describe the link and said that he'd written a book about it. And my sort of eyes got wide. I immediately rushed off, and actually if somebody can hit next slide on the, hit the space bar there, it'd be fine. I rushed off to the internet and bought his book called Computing in the Middle Ages. And it's just a great book, and I read it cover to cover and thought, oh my God, this is a tremendous innovation from a time period that for me, because I wasn't focused on that collectively, and Gordon can, I imprinted on later things, right, Gordon? The nomograph. Gordon Bell over here had come up with this concept that you imprint, generations imprint on certain machines and they don't really know what happened before. So I got re-imprinted on this machine, and for me it was a big eye-opener. And as we got to become friends and visited, I sort of thought, gee, it would be really great to do an event on the link as part of the DigiBarns annual big anniversary thing, because the purpose of our anniversary events is to bring something that is lesser known back and give it a full treatment. And I honor Jeff Raskin in this, in that I say it's filling the holes in the histories. He wrote an essay called that. We're going to fill the holes in these histories. We can do that. And so, lo and behold, one day, Sverro writes a bunch of the guys at this table an email saying, so, if we try to do something with a link, do you guys know of any source? And this is, I'll let Sverro give you more more background, but it turns out there were four of them parked in a garage in St. Louis. Four units. Sort of a magic number. You can probably get one working if you have four. That was the concept. And so from that point on, it became a possibility that the next year, and it would turn out to be the 45th anniversary, and my 45th year on this planet, so sort of like, I grew up with the link, but I didn't know it existed. Anyway, and I'm starting to show wear and tear myself. My tape drives don't work very well either. Anyway, so it became a possibility, and throughout the year, of say starting around the fall of last year, it became more and more of a possibility, and the guys actually started to look, and they concluded, and I won't steal their thunder, that they could get a machine working. And so then we went into logistics mode. We contacted Gordon and said, guess what? Gordon had just sent an email out to a list here at the museum about what we got to do something about the link, because there's one here. And I said, guess what? There's one in the middle of the country that is probably going to be restorable. And he got all excited. And Gordon provided sort of key support, key logistical and inspirational support to actually allow us to imagine trucking the thing out here. And that's why it's sitting in the next room. And so without further introduction, because there's a lot more real juice coming here, I'll hand it over to Sverro, but I just want to say thank you for, in advance, for everybody who's just worked incredibly hard to make this happen. And I will say it, and I know it's controversial, but I think of the link as the first personal computer. And I'll probably make some closing remarks if there's no arrows sticking out of here. But so, Sverro, do you want to take it from here? And I'll go and run the slides.
We all about study. See.
Oh, these are the people.
Can you hear me? Speak up. I told my wife I was going to do this, and that I needed a timer, of course, to time these folks. And she said, you don't need a timer, you need a hook. And so that's what this is about. And too bad this carpet is so soft, it doesn't make much noise. Anyway, I want to thank Bruce for bringing us all together. He thinks that we came here to do this show. We actually came here to see one another. We haven't seen one another together for 40 years. We don't want to think how long. But in any event, we're glad to see you all here. I know about half the audience in this place looks like, maybe a third. I guess the question that I wanted to avoid the what Bruce just said, the business of the first personal computer. You can get hung up in the semantics and forever. So we're not going to talk about that. We're just going to talk about the link itself for the most part. Certainly the Alto is the first machine that would be recognizable by people who are using computers on their desks at home these days as having a very similar facade. It's the first machine that a large number of people used that had the graphical user interface that we all know and love or hate today. But what Bruce didn't know was that many years earlier, back in the early 60s, that we had in fact built the link. And it was really entirely Wes's idea. The rest of us were hangers-on and liked the idea, but the trouble that we're going to have today is, in some senses, resetting all of you to the early 1960s. Because the link really did, in my mind, represent a major shift in the way people viewed computers. Up until that time, the machines had been really large, expensive, and it was just accepted that they would be that, and that they, therefore they needed to be shared. And at that time, time sharing was being explored, starting to be explored, on the theory that these machines would forever be expensive and that you needed to figure out how to share them. Actually, out of time sharing has come some multi-processing techniques that are existing in computers at home. But prior to that, you know, people arrived with their decks of cards. It was not too many years before that the transistor was invented. It's really hard to realize how many things took place in a hurry back during that period. In any event, Wes decided that we should just simply build an existence proof that you could build a small machine that could be used interactively, cheaply enough so that it could be dedicated to a single person. And I think that probably is the thing that primarily characterizes the link. It's the most important thing about it. It's really a break with the notion that you have to share large machines. Let's see, I seem to have 3 minutes left. I'm going to tell a story. It's about communication, and it has to do with the Pope. And a few hundred years ago, the Pope, it seems, declared that the Jews had to leave Italy. And the Jews, of course, didn't like this, so they got together and complained, and the Pope said, well, okay, I'll tell you what, we'll have a debate. You guys select your favorite rabbi, and he and I'll have a debate. And if I win, you guys got to leave, and if he wins, you get to stay. So they did, and they got together, but then it turned out that the rabbi didn't speak Italian and the Pope didn't speak Hebrew. So they sat there in chairs facing one another, and the Pope raised three fingers. And the rabbi raised one finger. And then the Pope circled around his head, like this, and the rabbi pointed at the ground. And the Pope brought out the chalice and the wafer, and the rabbi brought out an apple. Whereupon the Pope stood up and said, you win, I give up, you can stay. So then the cardinals gathered around the Pope and said, what happened? What happened? And he said, well, you know, I raised one finger or three fingers to indicate the Holy Trinity, and he raised one finger to remind me that there was one God between us. And then I circled my head to show that God was everywhere, and he said, yes, but God's right here too with us. And so I then pulled out wine and the wafers to say that you know, God forgives us for our sins, and he pulled out the apple to say that, well, sins are still with us. And so then the rabbi was queried by his friends, and they said, how did you win? And he said, beats me, I got no clue. And he said, you know, he said, you got 3 days to leave. And I said, I gave him a finger. And then he said, we're going to round you up and get you out of here. And I said, we're staying right here. And somebody asked, well, what happened then? And he said, well, he pulled out his lunch, so did I. hope to do a little better with communicating this afternoon than that. It's really very hard to put yourself back where things were in the 1960s and to imagine. We're so accustomed to the notion that computers are tiny and small and we carry them around with us and so forth these days. But it really was quite a major break then. Okay, well, I've used up almost all my time, and it's now time to introduce these fellows. We're going to have two sections of this today. The first section, we're going to talk about the link itself and its history and some of the applications. And then we're going to switch over to the other team on the other table over there. These are guys from St. Louis who actually made the brought the link back to life, and they'll tell you their story. Second, so we're going to do this first. Now, let's see, let me name these people. And I'll start over here. This is Jerry Cox.
The third section is everybody can go into the exhibit hall and meet the link afterwards.
Yeah, it's sitting over there. Is it running, guys?
Yeah.
You left running? Okay.
It's more or less running when we left.
That's Gerald. He always has a more or less to it. Okay, well, let's see. Let's start again here. This is Jerry Cox from Washington University. Mary Ellen Wilkes, who had joined us at the Lincoln Lab and is a lawyer now. Wes Clark, the principal designer of the link, and I think the rest of us, as I say, we're not secondary designers. We just did what he told us. Gerald Johns over there, then Maury Pepper, Scott Robinson, and Tom Chaney. Scott, it was, by the way, who had the foresight to put the links in his garage at the time they became obsolete. And none of us would be here today if it hadn't been for him. So let's see, there are a few other people here. In fact, there are a whole bunch of other people. Maybe you could just ex-link people. Howie Lewis over here, raise your hand, Howard, so people can see you. Howie was with us at Lincoln Lab and stayed with the group when it moved to Washington University. Warren Littlefield, Maggie, over here. And let's see, where's Sandy? Sandy Stewart. And her daughter, Tara's here. There's so many relatives here that, let's see, I can't introduce all of them. I think, have I missed anybody crucial?
Wes? Help. Ivan's here somewhere.
Ivan, well,
Chuck
yeah.
Here.
Yeah, but he,
well,
Ivan just simply applauded. He didn't, he was a TX2, certainly. I mean, we can't go through the whole audience. I think we better quit. I'm over my time. Okay, Wesley, you want to take off and do your thing?
Sure.
No.
It's all yours.
I want that, or I want that.
Would you rather have this?
I want this one.
It'll work. The board as well. How about you put the other one near you, but that one is really good.
This will work fine if you can hear me. Well. I like to express myself in large transformational projects. Unfortunately, I was never able to put enough venture capital together to... Unfortunately, I was never able to put enough venture capital together to undertake the redesign of the island of Crete, which needs a lot of work. It has all these old buildings on it, some of them really crumbling. And so over the course of my early career anyway, I spent some time with projects of much lesser scope, as it were. And many of those at MIT. Now, I suppose you're wondering how it is that machines designed and built at MIT ended up in St. Louis. And it's really very simple. Can I have the first slide? There we are. Now, this is a very simple machine. It isn't something that you really need to talk about, nor are you interested in diagrams of this kind, I suppose. Just go ahead, Bruce, or for another couple. But it had an interesting property that you could break up the word into sub-pieces and tie them together in interesting ways. And, well, just go. I can't see what you got there. Yeah, nine of these examples of controlling what was turned on during the execution of a given instruction and what was not, and so on. This is really very interesting.
Wesley, today it's the link. That's TX2.
Wrong machine?
Wrong machine.
Oh.
Try again.
Bifocals. right. Okay. I knew that. thank you. I suppose you're wondering how machines designed and built back at MIT ended up in St. Louis. Could I have the first slide, please? like the session as a whole, my part is going to be divided into exactly two parts. In the first part, I'm going to talk about the early work at Lincoln Laboratory. In the second part, I'm going to talk about what happened when we moved down to the MIT campus from Lincoln Laboratory after MIT had fired me for the first time for insubordination. Then the third part will be after we moved to St. Louis, and then the fourth part will be about some of the later years. I guess I have to say now that, as you know, there are only three kinds of people in the world: those who can count and those who can't. Let's see. Now I want the first slide, which would be this glorious picture. Yes. The man in the middle is George Paik, who founded the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, which we all know about, Xerox PARC. He would be my provost at Washington University. He and Jerry Cox, Professor Cox at Washington University, are responsible for the fact that after MIT fired me for the second time for insubordination, we ended up at Washington University. All right, and the man on the left is, of course, Charlie Molnar. Both George Paik and Charlie Molnar are no longer with us, very sadly. But they are the ones responsible. Jerry will be talking more about some of that stuff. Now, the slide will show the team back at the Lincoln Laboratory that I had managed to put together. And this is the team that built the first Twink in 1962. It's like 61, 62. There is Severo over here on the left talking to Tom Stockybrand, who's the man who made the world's most frightening magnetic tape unit for the TX2. And also the prototype of the magnetic tape unit for the link. Behind Severo, you see Mary Allen talking to my secretary, Joe, who later created the band below her, by the way. And up at the very top, you'll see in the picture Charlie Molnar in his Air Force uniform. He was assigned to the Air Force Research Center there at the fields where the Lincoln Laboratory was located. And you'll see Howard Lewis in there. Yes, Howie, there you are. About one step over and one step down from there. Oh, you have a pointer. Where did I have a pointer? Who has the pointer? All right, you guys. Don't really need this group. Scott. Scott. Hey. Thank you. Can I work it? Actually, I don't really need a pointer. I think I can, you know, the slide jumps. Unfortunately, sadly enough, one picture. One guy who's not in this picture, well, two people who are not in this picture, Charlie Molnar's sergeant assigned to him at the Air Force laboratories there, Dave Stewart. But Sandy Stewart is with us and some of her family as well. Now, let me see. Okay, Bill Papian, the man who built the first magnetic core memory, without which none of us would be here today, probably, until, well, at least we had to flounder along until we had integrated circuit memory, but in those days all we had was magnetic cores. And he's not in this picture, but we'll have a picture of him later. Now then, if you show the next picture, which I hate, yes, It's this Brooks Brothers pose. Its only purpose is that it shows the machine as it was in 1962 when we demonstrated it at the Lincoln Laboratory. So that's its official semi-public. I guess it was an open meeting, but mostly Lincoln people. And that was the first official presentation. The next picture, however, is a picture of Charlie during that early phase of the work, and he's there working with parts of the Lincoln, parts and some other parts, and there we got it designed so that that they would be mountable in relay racks at the time, and the reason for that will be clear enough in a moment. The next picture, if we can get Bruce's attention to push the button one more time. Is this coming through all right?
Pick up a bit.
Pick up a bit. Chip down a bit. Pick up.
Speak up.
There we are. Oh, wow. Wow. Everybody hear that?
Yeah.
All right. I also resonate at room frequencies, and so it's a little awkward. Okay, the next slide. Yes, this is a picture from my very early notebook of that period from 1961. That's the first appearance of the magnetic tape unit that I had in mind, down in the lower left-hand corner there. And as you can see, it would have been quite hard. Now, the link I wanted to make sure was used in biomedical research. Charlie, its co-designer, was in fact doing his doctoral work in the laboratory called the Communications Biophysics Laboratory at MIT, where they were taking cats apart, or at least studying the behavior of its auditory system by sticking electrodes in and that sort of thing. I had built a small machine for them earlier, of no great consequence, which did some averaging. And I wanted to make sure that the link could do that stuff. Now the next slide, the next few slides, will show pictures of the stuff on the link screen taken by Polaroid camera back in 1962 or 63, just at the transition of the time. You don't need to know that yet. The slide showing the cursor, it's that third lower left-hand slide. This one, yeah, that guy. That's a cursor that knob controlled, spun over the input. It's an analog input, by the way. It had analog digital converters in it. And as you move the cursor along with one knob and travel up and down the whatever waveform you're looking at, in this case a waveform, it didn't have been. And the number, the value, and the value shown on the left. Okay, and it made pretty good pictures, so next slide. So anyway, we took it down for a roadshow. We had a little show and tell at a special meeting of the National Academy of Sciences in Washington. And thereafter, we moved it over to the laboratory at the National Institutes of Health, the laboratory of Dr. Robert Livingston, who was then the chief of the Division of Neurology at NIH. Would you show the next slide? We hooked it up, Charlie hooked it up in very short order to a cat on one side. That's a mascot that they had running around the lab there named Jasper, and the other end was connected to their analog input of the link. And Livingston was thrilled, as you can read from the text there. If you can't read it, perhaps I should for you. No, you can read all that. He was dazzled, and so was NIH. So they offered to put a lot of money into the operation, and Lincoln Laboratory fired me. They didn't want any National Institutes of Health money. It was all defense. So they said sorry, you have to find somewhere else. So then we moved down to the next slide. This partitioning. Yes. Oh, summertime. There we go. There's Howard Lewis. We wired together some frames. What happened was NIH, when we ended up back at MIT, after they'd had second thoughts after a few months of very dismal time for us, we settled back in a Nature Food Center building in Temple Square. Yeah. And we put that stuff together frame by frame, had them wired up. There you are. Keep going now, because we're going to move right along rapidly, says the man with the hook. And you can just go to the next slide. The slide of Charlie. No, that's a backup one, not please. This one here. So Charlie has the scope of him to check out some wiring. Next slide. So visiting scientists came with an evaluation committee that had been set up by the National Institutes of Health. And the idea is we build a dozen or so of these machines and send them around to the labs around the country interested in biology and medicine, and they would try it out for a while. So with the next three slides, you see these people from our visiting team during that summer of 1963 putting things together, and there you have it. Okay, so that was that piece of the story. And finally, I guess, with one last slide showing Charlie and me at the end of that summer. Well, NIH had put up $27 million in a seven-year grant. $27 million would be roughly, a quarter of $1 billion to $1 billion today. So it was real money. And 7 years, it was unheard of. They had never done anything that big. It was a very, very, very. But in any case, there was a falling out, and MIT said, hey, we can't do it your way. We have to do it our way. And I said no. And so they fired me for the second time for this coordination. And we went it out to St. Louis. Now, in St. Louis, here's a picture, I think, of me with Jerry Cox. I guess I'm talking to Jerry in my office there in St. Louis. Next slide is a picture of Severo and the very young Gerald Johns. Severo was supervising him to make sure that he did everything quite right, you know. And the next slide is a picture of Tiger. Scott Robinson, Tiger. You don't let him talk you into a bout of arm wrestling, by the way. Tiger, you were about the same age, weren't you? About 20 when you went to that. Jerry Williams, they tell us about that. Then there's a picture of Michelle Stuckey, who isn't in our anywhere here today, doesn't like to fly or travel. And he's with Howard Lewis again looking over something. And the next slide shows Charlie preparing for a lecture at the med school, where he had come finally after he's completed his degree and his military service, and he was preparing a lecture for the med school. Then there's a picture I treasure because even though it's a Maury, it's a great picture in the dark. It looks good, showing Maury at the console of the link. We don't have consoles anymore, as you know. And then there's a picture of Mission Surveyor checking. Oh, no, this is a picture of the link kit. We had put things together. I mean, we got them organized in kit form so that people could build their own. But it's a pretty big kit, as you can see. And you can see various parts and you see them all together if you go outside and look at it. And here's the last picture. There is a Mission Severo checking that out and make sure it was all exactly right before we let anybody buy it as a kit. We didn't sell it, but other people could. It was all public funded stuff, so it was all free. Well, we did charge it for the documentation. Okay, well, then there were some years later after that, so you can go on to the next slide. I'll whip through this quickly. We just had to show there. Oh, no, that's not the last of them. Back up, please. What did you say? Oh, that was that badly out of order. We need to go up to something called here four. Four. Can't see it. Yeah. Go ahead. There we go. I just wanted to show you that when you took this stuff apart and built it into a laboratory, it was really crowded. Those labs were really full of equipment. If you look around, you can see the link. Here's another picture of another lab. There you go. And yet a third one, I think, just so you can see the link parts. And finally, there's this wonderful picture of Charlie Molinar that was taken just shortly before Ivan had persuaded him to come out and join his group at Sun Labs. And we miss him a lot. And then some years after that, I accepted an award for the architecture on behalf of the group in a modest ceremony, and that's the end of my story. Okay.
I'm Mary Ellen Wilkes, as Sarah said, and I think this is all terribly exciting. And these wonderful guys over here who made it all possible for us to be here today and gave us a real reason for getting back together and doing this. I am going to focus primarily on some of the software that we developed for the link. I first joined the group in 1961, and my first principal job was simulating the link on the TX2 at Lincoln Laboratory, the TX2 being a machine of impressive size, scope, and speed. And so I simulated the link again. Leslie and Charlie, of course, kept changing the design. It was all new, everything was new. My other job, aside from trying to program, simulate the TX2 to behave like a link, was to ask them lots and lots of questions about how the link was actually supposed to behave and what its performance characteristics were going to be. So there were various bouts of that. The only other thing I really remember about simulating the link on the TX2 was the midnight and graveyard shifts that you had to sign up for in 2 or 3 hour blocks. And my frequent ship in the night companion at that time was Ivan Sutherland, who was doing the initial work on Sketchpad. So that will put this in some historical context for you. And we literally passed like ships in the night at 2 or 3 in the morning as he was coming off ship and I was going on, or perhaps the other way around. After the summer of 63, when we had the Link Evaluation Program, I decided to take a year off and go around the world. And again, just to give you a little historical context, my last day at work for that time around was November 22nd, 1963, which was the day of John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I came back just about a year later, late 64, and very much wanted to rejoin the group, but I was not, by this time they had moved to St. Louis. And I wasn't at all sure I wanted to move to St. Louis. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. But there was a big piece of the Link project, or other pieces too, but there was a big piece of the Link project that had yet to be done, and that was a decent operating system. We had gotten by up to that point with basically assembly programs and some rudimentary editing programs. But meanwhile, the memory size of the link had been expanded from 1,000 words to 2,000 words, which made a huge difference in what we could do with a combination of link, scope, and tapes. And I very much wanted to work on that project. So Wesley said, no problem, you can stay on. My parents lived in Baltimore, and I thought I would just stay there for a while until I decided where I was going to move and what I was going to do. Wesley said, no problem, we'll just send you a link. We have the first slide, please, Bruce. There is the link in the living room of my parents' home in Baltimore, just outside of Baltimore in the Green Spring Valley, in early 19—I guess it must have arrived in early 1965. That's the stairwell up to our second floor. And I should perhaps mention, with respect to some of the other things that are on the table there, that strictly speaking were not actually part of the link kit. And in that connection, I think I need to mention that my father was a clergyman. And if you look very closely, you will see a Madonna just behind the keyboard. Can you all see that, or do I need a pointer?
No.
All right. He was very high church. And we seem to be on kind of a religious theme today. Popes and clergymen and Madonnas and so forth. And let's have the next slide, Bruce. This is just another view of the same set. Oh, the Madonna's even clearer in this picture. Good. And the next slide is my parents, my father and my mother. I'm not quite sure what they're doing, but you can make up your own story. And then the fourth slide in this little series, that was me in 1965, I guess working late. And I was in Baltimore, I think, with the link at home for, I think, perhaps almost a year. I really don't remember, but it was several months. And that is where the operating system that the link came to me, known as Lab 6, where that was first written, first developed, first designed, and worked on and debugged. And in that connection, one of the things I did that spring was to make visits to several of the laboratories that had participated in the Link Evaluation Program. I had a lot of ideas myself, of course, about what this operating system should look like, and so forth, but I wanted to go and talk to the participants to find out how they had been using the prior, rather basic system that they had, what they used it for, what they didn't use it for, what they liked, et cetera, what they didn't like. And I came back with log notes and some new ideas, and the primary focus here, which is hard to relate to now perhaps, is that this machine, everything about this machine, of course, was designed to be used by lay users, not by computer professionals. And all these biomedical researchers, although they were very smart and they learned to program it and they learned to do all kinds of things with it, they were still basically lay researchers. They were not computer professionals. And so the operating system also had to fit in with that environment. And I'm going to talk a few seconds here about what that looked like. So the driving factors in Writing Lab 6 were really things like simplicity and reliability. We had the quaint notion at the time that software should be completely, absolutely free of bugs. Unfortunately, it's a notion that never really quite caught on, I've noticed. But at the time, the idea that you would send out a program or a piece of equipment that had a bug in it was unthinkable, absolutely unthinkable. So, and I actually think, as far as I know, when Lab 6 was finally released, it had no bugs in it. At least if it did, I never heard about it. But that was a very high priority. Simplicity, what can a user reasonably be expected to remember? Do they have to look at a program manual all the time? What can they reasonably be expected to do to accomplish a certain task? Do they have to take six steps where one will do? What kind of control do they feel they have over their environment, over the computer and the environment? Do they feel like they're in charge, or do they feel like the computer is in charge? Things like that. Now, as far as Lab 6 itself is concerned, I come here today from a great distance because I've been out of the computer field since 72, however long it is, 35 years, I guess. And so in order to prepare for this, I actually had to go back and read a lot of stuff, including some of my own stuff. And one of the things that struck me about that material was that there were a number of similarities in the way Lab 6 and the link were operated by the lay user. A number of similarities between that and the way we all use computers today, our laptops and our PCs and our Apples. And I thought it might be more interesting for you if I just pointed some of those things out and, okay, and got on with it. could I have the next slide, Bruce? This is a picture of the lab scope in the process of working. Someone's working on a manuscript. The Lab 6 was normally was built around manuscript construction. That's the whole top of the screen there. And that's actually a link program, but the manuscript could be anything, any combination of characters, any kind of text, whatever you wanted. And you could also, Lab 6 was also responsive to, I think it was 17 what we call meta commands. At the bottom of the screen, you see an arrow, SM, graphic, comma, 1. SM is save manuscript. Give it the name graphic, save it on the tape on unit 1. Works the same as your save as command works today on the laptops. To edit the manuscript, all you had to do was locate it at wherever you wanted to do the editing. The manuscript at the moment is located at the end of line 1070, or the beginning of line 1071. And you just typed in, if you wanted to add stuff there, you just typed it in. If you wanted to delete stuff, you hit the delete key and it deleted backwards up through the text. The text itself is a continuous string of characters, an elegant algorithm that was thought up by Severo Ornstein and Michelle Stuckey in the early part of 1965. It's a little more complicated than I just described. I don't have time to go into it today. There is a journal article about it in the proceedings of the IEEE, it's on the website, it's on the DigiBurn website. There were other meta commands that you could execute that acted very much like moving text around today. You could add a manuscript to, this would have been called the working area. Adding a manuscript was like inserting one manuscript in the middle of another one. I also gave it a name, gave it a unit number where the manuscript was coming from. If you had started with a clean document here, no text on it at all, add manuscript worked just like going to a file or a folder on your computer and selecting the document and clicking open. Had exactly the same effect. You could save a part of a manuscript by giving it line number parameters, and that created a new manuscript with whatever name you gave it, so that that could be added into other manuscripts at other times.
Okay.
There was an index on the tape. There were copy commands for copying files and tapes and so forth. That's it. Thank you, Bruce. Happy birthday.
That was Jerry Cox. Wow. I'm going to get around here so I can see.
He's one of the few of us who can still stand.
So I can see what's going on here.
Oh, there's a button on it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, first slide. Next slide. How I met Weston Sharp. I'm an undergraduate student that built a small aperture out of deck parts. I wrote a grant application to NIH saying I wanted to build a laboratory computer for the auditory physiology lab of Halliwell Davis. And to my astonishment, the grant was awarded. And then I figured, I have to figure out some way to do this thing. And a deck module seemed like an obvious choice, but it was just a tiny company then up in Maynard, Massachusetts. So I went up there unannounced and walked in one morning and said, I'd like to technical information. And they said, well, our chief engineer isn't here today, but our CEO is, and he has some time. So I went in and sat down with Ken Olson and spent most of the morning talking about what I wanted to do, finding out about system modules. And at the end, Ken said, well, gee, you ought to go see Wes Clark at the Lincoln Lab. He's already done that. So that afternoon, I went over and was amazed at what Wes had accomplished, Wes and Charlie. And immediately figured that the right thing to do was to join forces and not try to do anything on my own. So that's what I did. Next slide. So we built a link by remote control from Boston with parts coming in on airplanes and putting them together in the basement of Central Institute for the Deaf, where I was employed at the time. And spending a lot of nights, it was great sport getting the machine together and very exciting. I was feeling a little guilty one night and went home and said to my wife, Bobby, gee, I'm sorry I'm spending so much time on this link. Maybe you'd like to go to the airport with me to pick up some parts. And she said, no. That would be like asking me to hold your pants while you visit your mistress. So, in any case, we got the link built, and here it is. It's the idea. Next slide. We then got a grant for the establishment of the biomedical computer lab at Washington University School of Medicine. And the place they found for us needed a little work. This is the basement of 700 South Euclid, where the biomedical computer lab and later Wes and his colleagues came. So this was not exactly a number one recruiting poster for getting the link group from MIT, but we managed it. And the way that happened was that I learned that things were not going entirely smoothly at MIT with Wes and the group.
and suggested that George Pate, our provost, might drop in. He did that. Said he was there for them to kick his tires. And lo and behold, a deal was worked out, and plans were laid for the group coming to St. Louis. Next slide. So they did come, but it wasn't entirely smooth all the way. There were lots of interesting developments. I was sitting in St. Louis. Wes and Charlie were in Cambridge. They were supposed to be writing a grant application. I got nervous about that, and unannounced flew up there and walked into their office and found them arguing about whether 2047 was a prime number or not. And so the origination of the prime number drop, which is a very advanced form of the pigeon drop, which you may know about from confidence games. The way that worked was that Charlie said that it was not prime. Wes said, well, what are the factors? He started dividing primes in, and I got terribly frustrated and said, you guys get busy on the grant. I'm going to go in the room next door, and I'll finish dividing the numbers in. So I finished dividing all the numbers up to the square root of 2047 and came back and announced, it's prime. And at that moment, Charlie stuck out his hand, saying, you want to bet? I said, sure. And then it was at that instant that Wes said, uh-oh. And it turned out that the numbers that he had divided in hadn't been quite right, and 23 was, in fact, a factor. So I claim to this day that that was a confidence game, and I was a pigeon. But I did pay off on a very nice dinner at a very nice restaurant in St. Louis. Next slide. Wes and I were slated to teach a course on computer design, and he announced an announcement that surprised me that the only way to teach a course on computer design is to get the students to design a computer. Well, that seemed, after he said it, to be a perfectly reasonable thing. So we allocated 4 weeks at the end of the course, got together some deck flip chip modules, and the students put together a computer. A later version of it was eventually used for radiation treatment planning. And here's Severo and I trying to help out the students figure out what was wrong with the computer. Next slide. Not all research projects turn out glowingly. We had an algorithm for fetal electrocardiography, and it was really slick, very, very cool algorithm. But even though it worked well, it didn't really catch on because there was no medical advantage to knowing about the fetal electrocardiogram beyond what was already known. So that hasn't really been a significant winner. But I noticed recently that it's being revived, and maybe even something will come of it today. Next slide. We also did analysis of the adult electrocardiogram, developed an algorithm called ASPEC for amplitude zone dynamic coding, because it does look like ASPEC runes in there someplace. And I think we spent almost as much time figuring out the acronym as we did developing the algorithm. Next slide. But we did apply that to cardiac arrhythmias in the coronary care unit. In fact, a new coronary care unit was opened up. We put in a classic one. This is P12. So earlier we had a classic one there. And on the opening, the eve of the opening day, the link, which had been running perfectly, failed. I was at my wit's end because there was a big celebration going on the next day and I wanted to have the link running. Called up Charlie Molnar in desperation, told him the symptoms, and almost without hesitation, he said, it's got to be the memory. Couldn't figure out why that was, but I went to the machine, took the memory out, and the sheet metal screw fell out of the memory. And it turned out that workman had been in putting in some air conditioning stuff just over the link and dropped the sheet metal screw. Next slide. And it fell all the way down through all the cards and lodged in the memory. But it had fallen out after I took the memory out. When the memory was replaced, it worked just fine. Next slide. Mary Ellen did a link bibliography. And here's a burst of publications that occurred between 1964 and 1969, a total of 151. And you can see the broad regions of biomedical research that were covered by publications that were stimulated by the link. Next slide. One good example was in neurophysiology. A lab at Washington U and a lab at the University of Wisconsin were two prime examples of the kind of work that was going on. Russ Pfeiffer is shown here with a cat in his lab at Washington U, and Joe Hine is shown from the University of Wisconsin. They did marvelous work in auditory neurophysiology, and Joe Hine also developed many collaborations which did important work with the link. Next slide. Unfortunately, Joe Hine passed away in 2003, and this is a snippet from an obit that was written. And I'll just read that. Joe Hine's most important technical contribution was to bring to the campus the first dedicated laboratory computer. Together with his colleague Dan Geisler, he introduced the link to this campus in 1963. It revolutionized the analysis of neural responses. Not only did it speed up data analysis by more than two orders of magnitude, but it also provided rapid online feedback of processed output that would enable hitherto impossible experiments to be carried out. Word of the link quickly spread, attracting medical scientists from diverse departments to see the new computer in action. Automated clinical laboratories, analysis, and automated patient interviews were thus born on that computer. So there are many areas that were stimulated by the link computer and the researchers that used it. Thank you.
Your turn. Howard's got a what may be the first digital photograph to show us.
Oh no. First big pixel.
Hi, I'm Howard Lewis. I was privy to join the Link Group back in 1962 and stayed with them until 1981. I'm gonna go a bit forward from 1962, the innovation of the Link. A decade later, in 1972, when at that time the link was really the workhorse of all of the projects and research that was going on with respect to the micromolecular project that we were doing at the time. But long about that time, this gentleman here to my left, Sever Ornstein, developed Wanderlust. And he had again to visit China. And as you recall, back in 1972, that was not the thing for a single individual to be doing. Severo developed a subterfuge where he induced a number of computer scientists to a proper visa to make a tour of China along with West Park. As I said, that was in 1972. In 1973, 1 year later, the Chinese sent a delegation to the U.S. to visit our computer development organization in the university. Bob Arnson, who was the mechanical engineer that designed most of the hardware for our computer micromodular projects, and a novice computer nerd, I might add, wanted to make sure that our Chinese delegation had some memento of St. Louis so they could take back to China and remember their visit to our great city. So he took his Nikon, went down to the city of St. Louis and shot the city hall with the newly erected arch in the background, reflecting the moonlight. He hurried back to the laboratory and quickly scanned the negative into the lamp with a densitometer that put output from 0 to 8, 0 to 7 actually, with 0 representing black, the shades of gray up to white, signified by the number 7. Our photography group, Gary Parker and David Chu, then got a huge substrate, pasted the corresponding shades of gray, black and white, in the corresponding places as dictated by the mic. Later, that large substrate was photographed and reduced by a factor of 4 and produced the image that you can see. So I like to claim that the Link was one of the first to produce digital photography, although it was a little subterfuge used. But this represented quite an effort by everybody in the office. I think every employee from secretaries to drivers to whoever was here dropped by at one time or another to paste a couple squares onto the substrate.
They're 1-inch squares?
Okay, now we're going to switch gears and start talking about the resurrection of the machine. And let's see the next slide. Oh, there it is. Everything in Silicon Valley, and that starts in a garage. And in this instance, the Link was stored for like 25 years, I think, in Scott's garage. And he's going to start off and tell us why in hell he put that thing, put all that stuff in there 25 years ago. So, Scott?
Pointer? Yeah. Gerald. I think it passed over.
I'm Scott Robinson, and I was hired as an electronics technician back in 67, and I had just turned 20 years old. And after being institutionalized all my life and being closely watched with my parents, you know, one day my dad gave me a phone call and he said, you're supposed to meet a Norm Kinch and a Professor Wesley Clark at the Computer Systems Laboratory, the old Schreiner's Hospital. And I said, what? So I got my car that I had just for 1 week, and I went down there and I had an interview with Norm Kinch. And I met Wesley Clark, and they liked the cut of my jib, which I did not know what that meant at that time. And they asked me if I would be interested in doing what I was told. And I said, that's 20 years old. And I said, that's all I've ever done. And so, to make a long story short, I became an electronics technician. And having slide number one, if you can show it, this is where I live, and that's my house, and that's a police car, by the way, that I bought. This is where I stored my four links that I acquired. I'll tell you exactly how that happened. But if I could have slide one up there, which is the mainframe. This is what I was taught to do in 67. This is the hard wiring of mainframe unit, central processing unit. This is the Z-box where the memory goes. And I first started doing all of my wiring here with number 22 bus wire using Teflon tubing. And we were using Teflon tubing because we thought that maybe someday these computers would still be working back in the 80s and the 90s and the year 2000 and beyond. And the foresight that Weston Clark had and Charlie Mulhern had was, they're absolutely right, because here it is, you see. Because the wiring would not disintegrate, having the normal wiring insulation, which would have been PVC, polyvinyl chloride. So the insulation would not break down, so everything is just as it was back then. And this is what I wish to do right here. If I could have one of the other slides, it's slide number two. This is my garage, where I kept everything. And this, I had the 59 Edsel right in front of it, and they happen to be the same color as the link. It's very interesting. And these are all of the pieces that I had. I had slide number three. This is the shelf that I had, and I had all of these stacked up here. And I actually had a few mice that had homes in here. But I also had cats that roamed through there, and they would occasionally come in there. So I had Russian blues at the time. Interestingly enough that they were not blue, but they were called Russian blues. And it's interesting how the links are blue too as well, incidentally. So as time went on, I kept these, hoping someday that some event like this would happen. Believe it or not, that's exactly what I had. And when I tried to procure these links from our department, from Fred Rosenberger, who was at the time our associate assistant director of the department, I asked him if I could have number seven, which was the link that I worked on, which is the one that we have. And he said, why in the heck would you ever want one of those links? And I said, because I don't want them to be trashed. In the second floor of the old Shriners Hospital, where our department was, we had four links lined up to be thrown away. And I was about to have that happen because I thought that if that was to be thrown away, that that would be like throwing away Wesley and Charlie. And I so dearly love those machines because, you know, I worked on the outside and the inside. I actually worked on the inside of the computer, not the outside, which means that I was a hardwired guy and not the programmer, okay? I also wired the dead terminal box, and I had a lot of projects in there that included discrete components and hardwiring and printed circuit boards. And I got a lot of that from Dave Stewart, who started me on making circuit boards and everything. And Howard Lewis over here, right here, you see, was the first guy that I really came to know very well, and I went to him with all of my questions. Who are these people, and why are they working after hours, you know, and what's all this about and everything? Well, it turned out he gave me my first discrete wiring project, and I wish that I had brought that here, but it came out of the semiconductor handbook. And if you remember that, Howard, late one Friday at 3:30, and of course everybody goes home at 4:30, right? Well, I wired that up, and the son of a gun actually worked. And it was to be plugged into the dead terminal box. And we went home very good, very happy. So from then on out, I did a lot of the discrete component work for the circuit boards that went into the dead terminal box, which happens to be this unit right here. And all of the projects that these engineers had would go in there. And they would, all of the results, of course, would come out on the scope, you know, and be stored on tape and everything. That was my job. Now, to tell you very briefly how I acquired these was that I went to Fred, and I wanted number seven, as I was telling you. And I wanted number seven because, you know, James Bond was number seven, and that was a big thing back then. And it had been in Tom Cheney's office, home there, and his little boy was Scott was actually working on one at that time, and I knew that it worked. So to make a short story long, as I was talking to Fred Rosenberger, he was telling me that there's a problem in me giving me that computer because it went from an NIH grant, and I offered money for it, and I offered to write him a check, and he said, well, that's paperwork, you can't do that. So I sat on that for about 2 weeks. So I went across the street over to Biomedical Computer Laboratory, where I talked to Stan Phillips, and they were throwing 3 links out. So I said, okay, I said, if they'll give me 3 links, then why can't Fred Rosenberg give me one? So I took 3 links home from BCL, and I also got number 7 by talking to Fred about it. And he said, well, how did you get the other ones? And I said, well, I offered him $3 a piece. He said, you paid $3 a link for 3 links? And he says, yes. And I said, well, then why don't you take home number 7, and we'll call it 3-4 for the price of 3. So I thought that was just like Kmart. So I took those home, and I kept those, and I had, at one address, I had it in my living room for about 5-6 years on my coffee table, and the mainframe was right next to the wall there, and the cables were long enough where they would go right around the perimeter of the house, and it didn't bother my cats at all. And so I kept that there. And then I moved to another place in 1991, where from that time to this day here, I had them stored in my garage. And so I was so glad that I actually did that, because all you guys are here, and I have them, and I have 3 more. Thank you.
Okay, which of you guys going to talk next? I can talk out of this. Go ahead, keep it. Is it Tom next?
It's Tom.
Oh, yes, these are slightly out of order, but that's all right.
Those are the ones I didn't talk about.
Okay, next slide is the beginning, actually. If you look at the display, you can see the large drawings that accompany these machines, and there were a series of drawing holders built in the laboratory. These are all out of plywood, and they fold the big manuals nicely. And if you go to the next one and look carefully, the HCL, C must be computer and L must be laboratory, but what in blazes is H? And it finally dawned on us one day that it's not a computer laboratory, but it's Howard Lewis's set of boards, and HCL is Howard.
Howard Clifford.
Howard Clifford Lewis. Next. Oh, there we go. All right. This is us moving the links out of Scott's garage into the facility which my son operates, which is the guy with these back to the gray. I have all these things. This guy. This is just a sequence, which is kind of one of these flip movie things. So Bruce, if you will just bang through those. As you bring it up, the caster's on the bottom, it wants to flip out. So you have to get your feet up on there. Go on, Scott. But there you go. Get your foot up to keep it from falling over. They're top heavy. And then just keep going. And goes up the ramp, and on up the ramp, and in the door. And there's Scott sitting inside, making sure everything came out right. Next slide. Yes, there it is, sitting in our space at STS Technologies, putting the whole thing back together. Next slide. We started taking things apart, and as Scott said, there were critters around. In this area, it's a little, but that is a mouse nest in the middle of the power supply, which all had to be cleaned out before we could proceed. Next slide. This is one of the principal switches on the leak console. And the reason I put this up is that that is a complicated logic device. Each of these contacts, there are instructions in the manuals to carefully adjust the spacing of those contacts. As you flip the lever down, that the contacts open and close in the right order. So when you flip that switch, you're actually doing a fairly complex set of instructions, just in moving the bat handle. Next one. But you'll hear a bell, which is this fellow right here, which sounds at appropriate times, and also there's a speaker there, which you can hear the machine running tied to a bit. And if you're spending a lot of time working on one particular program and making just small changes towards the end of the development, you learn to hear your program, and you know which loop it's running in, depending on the sound. That's all from that speaker. These capacitors were, that was the only capacitor in the machine which had lost its electrolyte, and we had to replace that capacitor. Yes, next slide. Yes, there's a story behind this, of course. When we first built the link, the memory turns out that all of its sense lines were connected between minus 3 and minus 18. And this being in the early days when things were expensive, you didn't put extra parts in things. So if there's nothing connected to the minus 3, it set at 0 volts, and you had to actually pass some current through it before it would move down. And we measured the minus 3 in the power supply, which is this piece down here in the bottom, and it measured 0 volts. And of course, I was in debug mode looking for one thing that would cause that, and I couldn't think of one thing anywhere. And it finally dawned on me that the reason that the minus 3 was a 0 volts is that an entire module, the memory module, was not properly plugged in. The contacts take about a half a pound a piece for insertion, and the memory has 8 rows by 20 contacts. And of course, you're reaching way down inside the machine. So I ended up literally, this is obviously faked a little bit, it's kind of fun to do, but I did in fact use that 8-pound hammer, and I did in fact use a lever bar in order to finally get the memories inserted. Next slide. There it is, down inside. The memory is right there, and that's my fulcrum point, and then pushing back here. Next one. After we got things sort of running, some people came to town. Wesley is there, and I guess he's the only one from out of town. And the rest of us gathered that had been working on this. And at this point, the machine is sort of working from time to time. And I just like that picture, so I put it in there. Next. There's another part of machines that you really can't do in a big timeshare thing, especially if your shift is from 3 to 6 in the morning. And that is, use the machine on Saturday mornings as your babysitter. This is my 42-year-old son. When he was 6, sitting at the machine, he would come in with me on the weekend and play tic-tac-toe, and there was an Etch-a-Sketch program and several other games that he would play. So we had enough machines sitting around we could do this. And one quick story. Of course, I taught him enough binary math that he could set the switches himself, and he had his own tape that he kept on the drawer in my desk. So we'd come in, and he would grab the tape out of the drawer of my desk and disappear and go elsewhere in the laboratory and find a machine and pull one of these high chairs up and crawl up on the chair and sit there and load his tape and play his games. And across the way, there was a graduate student who had just joined the laboratory and was trying for the first time to get his tapes loaded and get the right switches set and hit the DUTOG button and hit the start 20 all in the right sequence. And he was having a terrible time. And he told me much later that was a real low point in his life. When after fighting with this machine, this little kid came out, grabbed his chair, dragged it across the floor, hopped up on it, and was busy playing. So anyway, another part of also not just working 8 to 5. Next slide. And of course, being your grandpa. This is my grandson, my son's son. Will is now 12 years old, so he's twice the age of Scott when he was in front of it. This was posed recently, just before we tore the machine down. And the next slide Yes, it was the two of them. This was my son now and my grandson. And I think that's the end.
I believe Gerald's next.
I am?
Yep.
They wouldn't ever tell me what they were going to say. This is all a surprise to me.
Let's try a slide and see. Ah, it is me. I don't really have that much to say. I was the one who sat in front of the machine and tried to figure out how to make it work when nothing worked. When I joined the laboratory in 1964 in St. Louis, the first job I was given was to write test programs for the machine. This was a great way to learn the instruction code because you had to go through every single instruction in the machine, and first you had to understand what it was supposed to do before you could write a test program to see if it did it. That led to a rather thick manual. You can't see it very well in this picture, but it's probably an inch and a half thick, and it's mostly program listings, although it includes words from Severo and other people on how to do the initial assembly of the machine. Let's see the next slide. Basically, with a machine not working at all, once Tom got the power supply to apply power to it, you would notice that many of the lights didn't light. And so we pulled lights out of another machine and slowly worked through all of them. They just pull straight out. The only way we could get a light of this sort was to cannibalize it. You can't run out and buy this kind of thing anymore. So once I trusted the lights, then I started to look for the things that were supposed to drive the lights. So we started with the A register. That's the easiest one to manipulate from the console. And sure enough, I thought I'd have to replace a package. There were two lights that were out. I went around the machine, peered into the cabinet, and there was no card in the slot. That was an easy one to diagnose. So we actually didn't have very many bad cards. The typical symptom was either the card wasn't plugged in, it was the wrong card for the slot, or there was no card there at all. So once we corrected that, the machine could actually run instructions from the console. The do toggle over there allows you to execute any instruction in the Lynx repertoire right there from the console. Well, and I said, okay, I'll store a little program in the machine. Then I discovered that the memory wasn't working at all, which led to Tom's sequence figuring out that it wasn't just not working, it wasn't plugged in, even though it looked like it was. The memory is so large and fits in so tightly that it isn't that easy to tell if it's plugged in or not. Anyway, if you ever want to restore a 45-year-old computer, don't think in modern terms. Think in terms of corrosion and parts that just aren't there. This is a picture of the console as we first received it. When Scott and others at BCL had packed the machine up to go to Scott's garage, they had carefully taken the black bat handles off of these expensive switches and put them probably in a paper bag to go along with the machinery. Well, after 25 years, we still had the machinery, but no handles. So you can't just, again, run out to the catalog and buy some of these. So next picture. A combination of Jerry and Tom managed to get some manufactured. It's surprisingly expensive to do that for a very small quantity like were made, I think about 12. Anyway, they work a whole lot better than sticking your thumb on those screw threads. And that speeded things up a bit. So, next picture. The Link, as many of you know, is made out of these deck system modules, which are this big in real life. These are germanium transistors. Luckily, as I said, we didn't have any major card failures, so we didn't have to figure out how to interpolate a modern transistor and a few components into a situation that was designed for a slightly different technology. So anyway, that's all I have to say. If any of you care about playing with a really old machine, come on over to the exhibit, and we'll let you peer inside and touch things.
Okay, Maury, what you got to say?
Okay, I'll go rapidly through a few different things and end up with the demos. And Bruce, when I get to the demos, just be prepared to do some pausing and volume changing. Because my part on the restoration was really not very much. Gerald and Tom had already started on it, and Gerald got a hold of me when he realized he needed some of the documentation that nobody else seemed to have, and I lived up to my pack rat reputation and had a lot of stuff in my basement. Oh, my archives. I still do have an awful lot of documentation, and was able to make some duplicates and get them going, especially on debugging the tape drive. So my part really has just been to be there to heckle and provide documentation, and I come over with my bucket of link tapes. I've got about 60 of those. And the surprising thing is that the link tapes are, every one of them that I've pulled out so far that was sitting in my basement since 1974 works fine. Fortunately, because some of the stuff that people thought was lost was there. And one of the things we were really happy to be able to retrieve was Gerald's music programs, which you can come and listen to Bach's favorite instrument, the link. So moving on to some of the part that I played at the laboratory in St. Louis. I really arrived late on the scene in 67. The machine was done. They were all built. They were out there. They were being used by researchers. So what fell to me was Mary Ellen was totally sick and tired of Lab 6 by that point. I think she actually was a bit nauseous when you mentioned it. And so I became the Lab 6 librarian and was corresponding with all of the other laboratories, keeping them up to date with the tech memos and the things that were going on. And I hate to burst your bubble, but I came across a couple of bugs in the archives of letters, some of the most obscure things, like if the file name was too long and it was Thursday, it would pick up. So, there were even bugs in Lab 6, but we got them all out. There's some waiting to be found, I'm sure. As a person who enjoys puzzles, the link was designed, but what I got to do was to understand it, and with people like Michelle and Severo around, I could ask questions from the people who knew the answers, and just spend an awful lot of time digging through the logic diagrams until I pretty well understood it, then that allowed me to be able to design the Superlink, which was a whopping 32K of memory. Thanks to Dick Clayton, we had a scheme for addressing the additional memory in 1K banks with what were called the upper and lower memory bank registers that got added on. So I wish I'd dug out the picture. I don't have it, but there is a picture of an additional 6-foot cabinet sitting next to the Lynx cabinet with 12 fans in the doors to keep it cool, with 8 of the Fabri-Tec 4K memory stacks. Each one costs $5,000. So $40,000 for the computer and $40,000 for 32K of memory. And there was only one of those. Somebody else at Duke University built another one, but I don't think they ever got it loaded up with that much memory. But that was fun. That's the kind of stuff that made it a real pleasure to work at a place like that. I got to work with Charlie Molnar and the picture you saw earlier, Russ Pfeiffer, in the cap in his laboratory with the cats. The real work that was going on there was trying to understand the auditory nerve, and I got to write a program for them that was the auditory nerve simulation. And I couldn't figure out how to run it. I didn't have any documentation, I guess, or none that I kept. But what we have to show now is an awful lot of demos, you know, things that play music or play games. But there was a lot of serious work going on. Being able to write things like an auditory nerve simulation program for someone who was really making good use out of it was a pleasure. Howard reminded me of something that happened to me and the several others I found out. Sitting at the link and start hearing a funny noise, and then smoke starts coming out of the console. It turns out that almost every beginner got to experience Howard and Dave Lewis sitting often in a remote area with a long hollow tube, and they would blow smoke up into the back of the console. And what they did it for was so they could watch the reaction. Some people would just get up and walk away.
Howard, I didn't teach you that.
Yeah, normally they grab their tapes and run. And that's an interesting thing to point out. Those tapes, you know, you can relate those to floppy disks. That's really the same concept. The tapes didn't belong to the machine, they belonged to the individual. They were personal tapes, which is why, in a sense, you can call this a personal computer. When you wanted to work on something, you grabbed whatever tapes out of your drawer that you wanted, went to the machine, turned it on, started using it, it was yours. So, and you had a keyboard and a screen, and when you typed, you saw what you typed on the screen. It was totally interactive in today's mode of how we compute. When one of my professors from undergraduate school where I went in Omaha came down to St. Louis and happened to come by and I showed him what we were doing, he just couldn't get over it. I mean, this is the way computers should work. To him, computers were things with punch cards and punch tapes and, you know, just batch everything. It was a totally different mode of using the computer, and it didn't take long for the rest of the world to figure out this was sort of the right way to be doing things. So let's go on to the demos. I just brought my camcorder in one day and started running some of the demo. And oh. This is a program that's... can you pause for a sec? Okay, what you're seeing now is just Tom Chaney created a little RS-232 interface for us, and I wrote a program on my laptop that will just grab the output, so the program is capable of displaying it on the screen and grabbing it and putting it into a file. That allows us now to get index listings and program listings, and then Gerald wrote another program that allows us to dump tapes. Because we want to be able to preserve what's on these tapes. We're not sure that the tapes or the tape drives will last forever, but if we can get these things dumped and onto a modern magnetic, you know, and memories and files and CDs and so on, we can preserve a lot of this. What you're watching there is just the program that I wrote. Playing the part of the Model 33 teletype that the link was originally used for, but we beefed it up to run at, that one runs at 2400 baud. The original link was written to dump stuff out to the ASR33, a lot of you would be familiar with that, which ran at 110 baud. So this is about 20 times faster than the, you know, a lot more efficient. So go ahead and let that run. Thank you.
whistle was the tape running.
This is the process of cutting off the sticky part of the tape and adding a vinyl strip, which is not sticky, but holds the tape. Voila.
I don't know how that got in. So what do we got next? Okay, I'm typing an ad manuscript, and then the name of the manuscript, which is one of the free meta programs that we have. So you'll hear the tapes going. It's adding from the manuscript off of one unit into the work area that's on the other unit. It was a lot more efficient to use two tapes at once so that it didn't have to run up and down the tapes. Okay. And that's a piece of that manuscript. And now I'm typing a CV to convert that manuscript into a binary. In other words, it's an assembly program. With the audio tuned up, you can really hear that. That's the symbol table being displayed. Or no, it was first the memory allocation being displayed, and then the symbol table, and then it goes back to the manuscript. This is just demonstrating the Etch-a-Sketch program. We call it Etch. But basically, you turn two knobs in exactly the same way you do on the Etch-a-Sketch game. I have to apologize for the shaky nature of this. I was just really demonstrating what I could do with my camera to see what I should come back and really shoot for real with a tripod and everything. Oh, this is the random number generator test. I wanted to make sure that my random number generator was reasonably random. These are randomly placed spheres of random sizes. So that was just another test for my square root routine and the random number generator. And I think, was that the last one or is there one more? Oh, the music. There's Gerald. When people ask how we could justify, you know, writing games and playing music and so on, we point out this was all after hours. We pretty much lived at the laboratory. I was right across the street in the med school dormitories, and Gerald was about 10 minutes away, and a few others. We pretty much just made that home. We just, you know, hated to leave and go home and have to sleep, but we did now and then. But it was a place that was a pleasure to work. I mean, I can remember as a first or second year person there, I would tell people, you could offer me, there's no amount of money you could offer me to get me to go somewhere else. I mean, there was nothing else I would rather be doing than the work I was doing there at the time. And, you know, thanks to Wesley and Charlie and the most intelligent people I've ever had the opportunity to work with. And the work that survived, I think, is a testimony to that.
Severo?
We have Severo.
Severo?
Well, but I only have two things. We have four presentations to make here. Thank these guys. These guys did all this work over the last year in St. Louis. Travis, of course. And so, thank you. We have an award for Maury here.
Thank you.
And believe it or not, we have one for...
that's one of the typical ones. And now Leslie has his own award to present.
Ah, yes.
Right here. Oh, he needs this.
I need that.
Bye, Leslie.
Okay. Yes. I think unifocals will do it.
Scott, Tiger, you're the man who made this all possible. And a number of us got together, we chipped in, and we're trying to make you whole on your investment back in 1990,
whatever.
Oh, yeah. Make you good on your investment back in 1990-something. And 85, right. And but you got 4-3, you say. Well, okay, good deal. Now, big Dart is putting that this is without value, you know, it's beyond value, okay? And so we've actually given you, you brought out two machines, and we're giving you 4-2. And after looking around at the six, we found this bills are out of circulation. We had a few prints of it, but nevertheless, we managed to find these, and Severo had a friend in Boston help with that. And here it is in the unread inscription, and we've signed it, a number of us. The inscription says, in the matter of agreed balance due on assorted fiscal accounts relating to the foresight of Mr. Scott Robinson, in archiving several vehicle displacing computers and to his incalculable help in bringing to life one of their best.
Or you'd have blown all sorts of things.
Well, I don't know. But we have to do something for that?
It may have ran a little warm.
Down the ran?
In the basement. At the fuse box.
Yeah, the fuse box.
Oh, in the fuse box. Yeah, I suppose. I don't recall that we did anything.
It's about 18 amps, they call it. Paul?
I don't even mind. What was the link replaced with? Like, how did it go away?
What was the link replaced with? How did it evolve? What did it evolve into?
I evolved into consulting. I don't know what the link did.
Let's look into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Here,
right.
Go. Well, of course, Dick. We did the link.
Oh, Dick. Dick Link.
Hey, all right.
Hi there. My name is Dick Link, and I spent a few years in digital. And the salesman that sold all the modules to this crew, who sucked me into coming to digital, and to put together a machine that he conceptualized building that could be a link and a PDP-8 together, which would be called the Link-8. And Severo and Wes designed the thing, and some drawings were done for it, and we ultimately built the successor to that set of ideas, okay. So there were on the order of a little less than 50, I think, lights of various sorts, if I'm not mistaken.
Classics, yes.
Classic lights, so-called. And another company, Spirit Communities, in the Boston area, built a series of a couple, three models of Blink, and I think that totaled on the order of 50, if I'm not mistaken. And there were, the Link 8 came out, and you could program it as either a deviator or a link, but it wasn't very good together. It was two completely separate processors, same memory, same I/O stuff. There were about 130 of those, and I was stuck in jury duty after the Link 8 was pretty well along and we were starting to ship it. And I finally got to do this thing right. unlike the experiment we put on Wes and Severo. And so that was the PDP-12. And that was a machine that executed PDP, executed link code, and then I had a mode bit, and it then executed PDP-8 code. And you could literally switch back and forth between them. There were a few difficulties in getting the operating system sources to work smoothly and switch back and forth between programming modes, and that mixed up all kinds of interesting things and led to some fairly messy software work. And it just Gus Chiquenda was the guy that did a bunch of that work. And it was eventually called Lab 6.0, and he was what we called the software that wrote both sets of machines. And there were about 140 or so link gates, and I'm not positive of the number of PDP-12s there were. My recollection is it's either a bit under or a bit over 1,000, but I don't remember. It may be as few as 600. But that's what happened to that, and then the PC world overtook it, quite frankly. And the standardization of I/O and things became pretty heavy there. So that's my view of what happened directly after the
link. Integrated circuits, I think.
Yeah, integrated circuits made it all change very much, and then integrated processors.
Just a note, yesterday Len Shustek took most of this group down into the storage down below us here. And as you're walking along, you're pointing, oh, PDP-5, you know, PDP-12, et cetera, you could tell that the link sort of had grown into the medium because they all have the same dual tape unit on the front. It was so cool to see that, like sort of the genetic code of the link was in all these machines. It's fantastic to see it.
All the same color.
All the same color. another question coming in. You'll have to come up. And then we're going to slide the birthday cake in front of these guys, and we're going to do our ceremony business. We're getting a little bit late here. Speak your name.
My name is Andy Rondo, and I'm just wondering, how many hertz or how many calculations per second was the link? The instruction cycle time was 8 microseconds. Each cycle is broken up into 4 separate clock cycles, but the memory cycle time was 8 microseconds, and you could do some calculations in as little as 8 microseconds, but typically if you want to talk about calculations, an AND instruction took 16 microseconds, 80 kilohertz, 80,000 instructions per second.
Oh no, more than that.
Gordon, did you want to make any comments? I didn't bring it back. Gordon always has something to say. Come up here.
I was glad that Dick came up because, in fact, he extended the life of the link quite a bit and made all the software and user code. And so, that part of the story got in here. So the link just didn't stop with, you know, 50 machines and influencing those people, but went on and lived. And so as a lot of things, I still kind of claim it as the first personal computer. I mean, we've had a lot of email back and forth on that. But again, it's probably not something we want to get into here, because everybody here knows that the two Steves invented the personal computer. But anyway, just before that, there was another personal computer.
2 years ago in this room, we hosted the Homebrew Computer Club 30th birthday party. A similar setup and everything, cake, whatnot, and it just struck me, just hearing, especially hearing Mary and all talk about it. You know, there you are, there's a kit, and you're making these machines from a kit. It's a bigger, heavier kit. And people made the machines, and I think that they could be moving the station wagon, but, you know, truck station wagons, vans. Took it back home, started to code when you wanted, started to put these little tapes in the mail, you know, sending it to your friends, open source idea, and just the birth of this community is kind of a homebrew community in the mid-60s, you know, 10 years before, and, you know, that's what got me like, oh my goodness, this was so interesting to me that this had happened. It's the last thing the DigiBarn ever did as a project, which it won't be. This is a pinnacle of what I've been trying to achieve in those last 10 years of this project. Anybody else want to make a comment or statement? Ivan, did you want to say anything about that? Any more questions about Gordon's backup?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I basically just want to congratulate everybody for doing it. Very finicky to keep this going. And I hope the link now will persist in a software state and that we can keep it going for another few hundred years. I think that's an important thing. I'm glad all the nicest thing I heard, I think, was the existence of the Lint tape being readable. Because a lot of copies are not readable. In fact, it's a testimony of the way the analog redundancy was used on the tape, that in fact it is readable. And so, but I think the value of that is now we can take all that and make sure that those machines will run forever or whatever.
We actually just heard a few days ago when we were setting up that the Computer History Museum recently got a huge boxes of Lint tapes from Germany or something. It's a big addition to the collection. So, Al, myself, you're here. Maybe Gordon, you can talk. We could mount some of those tapes and not only characterize them and figure out if they're going to run what's on them, but dump them. So we ought to do that as a project. Get some of the, as they were describing, some of the serious applications that were written for the machine, not just the kind of play applications you'll see here, get them saved for the future.
I don't know whether anybody said it, but this machine that's in the next room is tomorrow morning is moving over to the DigiBarn, and that's where it's going to be its final resting place. So we hope to have it up and working over there by the middle of the day tomorrow.
And there's a link downstairs as well, so perhaps in a future project we get both of those machines running. And with the expertise we have assembled here. And I think with that, I think we're close to 3 o'clock or something. So what we need to do, because we actually have to be able to show you this machine, and then we have to start rolling it downstairs to the loading dock area sometime after that. And I have some VCF duties, notably we have an award ceremony coming up. So we've got to roll on to the cake here. If that's okay.
Let's go.